Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Peter Llewellyn. I run the services at medcomsnetworking.com. So, information services, resources, activities for people who work in and around medical communications, medical education, medical publishing, and the associated businesses across the globe. You'll find lots of resources if you go to medcomsnetworking.com, or for instance, go over to Network Pharma TV. You'll find there's hundreds of videos now on all manner of topics, many of which have been recorded from webinars like this. So today, absolutely delighted to have Carol with us. This is just going to be a conversation. Carol's a patient advocate. I would just like to start by asking Carol just to talk to us just very openly. I know you're going to be very open today. Tell us about yourself and your personal journey and the sort of conditions you're living with, and then we'll go on to talk about your sort of involvement in advocacy and so on. But just start with the personal journey, Carol.
Okay, thanks, Peter. Well, as Peter says, I'm a patient advocate, but first and foremost, always a patient. I've lived a life full of being told that I was just making everything up, to be perfectly honest. I've got a multitude of musculoskeletal problems that have caused me a lot of chronic pain and a lot of problems over the years. Sent me to physiotherapy a lot and orthopedics a lot and rheumatology a lot and being told that nothing was wrong. So I was 39 before I got a diagnosis of benign joint hypermobility syndrome. Don't know how they hadn't quite picked up on that before I was 39, being as I had arthroscopies and things in my knees and my, surgeon saying, "I don't know why your knees are defying the laws of gravity when they're coming out of socket and things like that," but that's just how it is. I've got bone deformities as well. I have the rare sixth vertebrae in the bottom of my spine, coupled with spina bifida occulta, which means I've got plates missing. And although spina bifida occulta isn't rare anymore, it's rare because it's coupled with the extra bone. And I was also diagnosed at 13 with mild scoliosis. So I've got quite a lot of musculoskeletal things, arthritis, osteoarthritis, plantar fasciitis in my feet, which is great because I was born with a very high insteps, actually, what they called ballet dancers' feet. And because of that, I've got very poor balance and coordination. And a whole host of things like that. I'm trying not to get distracted by chat.
Just
And
ignore that, don't worry.
whether or not I have hypermobility Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is up there in the air because, in my opinion, it doesn't exist yet because they haven't found the biomarker for it. So, although as a condition they're searching for it, I can't say whether I've got it because there's no biomarker. So that's from a research perspective with my own health. I've got a multitude of things that go with that. Fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue in particular, are two things that are really problematic. Two rare gene mutations, MYH11, which I believe is the cause of my obstructive bowel disorder because it's prevents the contracture of the muscles within the gut and the bowel. And another one, TNFRSF13B, crikey, that's a long mouthful, which is to do with the immune system and makes me highly susceptible to things that affect the immune system. So all in all, there's a lot more than that going
You've
on
got a
from a health perspective,
fairly fat file, haven't you? Can you
and I
just talk a little bit, just being a bit nosy here, but can you just talk a bit on a day-to-day basis, frankly? What are you coping with? I mean, have you got mobility problems? And just try and paint the picture a little bit, just so we know what a day involves for you.
Well, I wake up in the morning, and if I'm on my back, I'm like a tortoise stuck on my back. I find it very difficult to get up because my back is highly problematic. I have muscle weakness in my lower extremities because of the reduced mobility and stuff over the years. The connective tissue disorder makes it difficult to exercise. I can't exercise like normal people because I have to keep going and going and going and going and going and going. You never reach that ultimate point. You just never get there. And the moment you stop, it retreats and gets worse, so you end up having to start the battle again. So you end up fight it, it's just a never ending hamster on a wheel. You have to keep going. I have a bed rail that helps me get out of bed. I've had that since I was in my early 40s. I've got walking sticks that I've had since I was in my 20s, crutches, rollators, wheelchairs. Step stools, a whole host of gadgets for opening jars and things. On a day-to-day basis, from a mobility perspective, it's quite problematic, and it isn't until you're in that position that you realize quite how much you use your hands for things, or quite how much you end up adapting. I'm one of those people that can actually, I've adapted, I use my feet for a lot of things. So, although I can't bend down, I can actually lift my leg up so I can pick things up between my toes. And I've got long toes. It comes with the strange feet. And I can and I can do things like that rather than bending down. You adapt. So you do things like that. Cooking is awkward. I have to now, as I've managed to learn how to cook fresh without having to peel any vegetables, I now have to buy everything prepped. I wish I didn't have to, because it's like, it's lazy to buy everything prepped, but I have no choice because
Practical.
it's practical. The osteoarthritis in my hands prevents me from peeling potatoes and chopping carrots and things. Chronic pain, is something I have to manage on a daily basis through a number of things, through like stretching exercises, through the medication. So it's a combination approach. And anxiety and depression, mental health obviously is highly up there. It's something I've battled with since I was in my early 20s because nobody would hear me. And I know that people probably get sick of hearing patients saying that they don't get listened to, but it's true. It's a fact. You don't,
Just
they don't hear.
okay. I just and again, I guess I'm stating, I mean, you go up and down, I guess. I mean, I know, to be blunt, you've been not in the best of health recently, so it's a bit unpredictable, I guess. Your life's a little bit unpredictable. Is it as simple as you don't quite know what the day's gonna be like until you wake up in the morning, sort of thing?
No,
Is
you
that
don't.
oversimplifying
I
it?
mean, for me, I really don't. And it's been like that for 3 decades. I
Right.
mean, it's like, it's not like it's just been the last 5 or 6 years. It's been the last 3 decades.
So that's a
And
lot to learn to live with.
you would think that there would be a that the pressure would come off, that you wouldn't be under so much pressure from governments and everything else. But I am under pressure because they still seem to think I'm miraculously going to be cured by next week. It's like, nothing's changed in 30
No.
years. I've just got worse, but it's all right. I'll be cured by next week. Yes, it's a weird situation to be in when you've got multiple conditions. I mean, at the end of the day, you're living with one disease that's kicking you in the teeth one day, and the next day you get up and it could be something else, and or it could be you've got three of them kicking you in the teeth at the same time, but at no point in time is anything switched off. So it's not a case of managing one disease, you're managing a lot of diseases and conditions all at the same time. So fatigue, for instance, I mean, fatigue obviously through the lack of sleep, I mean, fatigue alone is absolutely, it's just awful. Anybody that lives with fatigue will quite happily tell you how bad that is, on what impact it has on your life. I mean, for me, I don't have narcolepsy, but there are times when I wake up with the laptop in my lap, the mouse in my hand, and it's about an hour and a half later because because fatigue is that. But I know I mock it, but I'm sorry, but mocking is how we've learned to deal
Part of
with it.
your coping mechanism. I
From
know.
with as patients, we mock it because we live with it, and that can be a bit hard for everybody in the outside world to understand why we mock it, but it's because it's normal to us.
I think,
It's
well,
not
one of the
normal to
problems with that
anybody
is,
else, but it's normal to us.
So the problem with that aspect, or can be, and in terms of communications exercises, you can mock it. It's very difficult for us or someone else knowing quite how far to go with mocking it, sort of thing. That and that's where the discomfort happens, I guess.
Yeah,
Just
you're
to
not
pick up on
wrong.
your point, just pick up on your point about hearing the voice, and it strikes me, it must strike anybody listening to you. You've obviously got a multitude of chronic disorders there, okay? You've had a long time dealing with the health service, healthcare professionals, and so on. Yeah, how's it? Just paint a little bit of a picture of how is it like dealing with medics and healthcare professionals. And I'm guessing part of the problem is finding someone that can look at the whole you rather than the bits and pieces. And how multidisciplinary is the team that looks after you? You can see what I'm getting at. So just paint a little bit of a picture of how you're handled by the medics, as it were.
Well, I'm going to actually move into the organisation now, Peter, because obviously, bringing up the whole multidisciplinary side of things, and one of the reasons why Flutters was born was because A, I was asked to do it, but also B, because there was this striking need for our health to be looked at more holistically, to be looked at from a more multidisciplined aspect. Because going in to see a GP about one condition at a time is no good. And that essentially is why things drag on as long as they do, why diagnosis takes so long, why diagnosis is often wrong. Because you get misdiagnosed or underdiagnosed is another one, or you just end up sitting in no man's land, not knowing who to talk to because nobody will listen at all. And for me personally, I don't want anybody to go through what I went through, which is why campaigning for this more multidisciplined approach to our care exists because. It's not how it is. It's very antiquated, I believe, the healthcare system at the moment, and it's not through the fault of the health professionals. Everybody has to work within the limitations that they're provided with to work within. But it is antiquated. Most of the patients in my network are like me, so they want to be able to go to an appointment where they're seeing the physiotherapist and or the orthopedist and the doctor and biomechanics and or gastroenterologist if need be, because a lot of us are under the care of gastroenterology or gynecology. I'm painting a picture. If you want to be able to see everybody all at once, I believe that it will help to not just cut costs, but it should also speed things up a lot. If and it's better for both the healthcare system and the patient, because the patient is getting all of these people around them at the same time, so you've got less chance of medication clashes happening. Everyone can decide as a team what treatments are better. What treatments are in alignment with each other and everything else. But it's always hit back with from people about cost because it's about cost. How can we do that? Because it's about cost. And it's okay, fair enough. It's going to cost a lot of money to maybe do that. And you can't just change a healthcare system like that and provide that kind of holistic approach. But at the end of the day, in the UK, there's all of those walk-in centres that they have all over the UK, and how many of them are sitting there empty? Because I know in Sunderland they shut a number of those walk-in centres down, and they just sat there empty. So why can't they have them set up as centres so they can actually have proper chronic illness centres where these things can happen? I mean, I'm not saying that it's a perfect idea, but surely it should be considered by now that that patients need this difference. I mean, I know I do. I can't deal with going to all these different appointments all the time anymore. Going left, right, and center and waiting 6 months and then, waiting another 6 months.
For the next one.
It's just
And
annoying.
I think you told me a story the other day about how I can't remember exactly, but I think you were talking to your rheumatologist or something, and he said, what would you like to happen? And you said something like, well, I'd like my dermatologist here, or I'd like it's like, you know, it, I mean it's there's a sort of a slightly amusing side to that, but it's but that's really the problem that a lot of us face with the healthcare system. You know, you've got your few minutes with one person looking at one problem, and he won't look at the other problem on the other foot or whatever it is, sort of thing.
The thing
So.
is, though, the thing is, though, Peter, is that these medical profession, I talk to these people, I talk to them about these things, and I haven't come across anybody yet that's disagreed. These are,
Exactly,
you're talking, medical professionals are agreeing with this.
But the system doesn't allow it. So I guess a lot of that experience leads, as you've touched on, into fibro flutters. So just give us a little bit of a sense of the story of fibro flutters and your role within that, yeah?
Back in 2013, along with benign joint hypermobility syndrome, I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia. And back in 2013, fibromyalgia didn't have a diagnostic code. And across the globe, fibromyalgia communities were trying to get fibromyalgia a diagnostic code. So there was a big, massive wave of campaigns right the way across the globe. And I joined a community on Health Unlocked through a charity called Fibro Action at the time, and ended up becoming a volunteer and then ended up becoming an admin because raising awareness for a condition that needed awareness was quite important to me. The hypermobility was already well researched. It was already, there was a lot of information out there, but the fibromyalgia was one where people were being told it was psychosomatic still. It wasn't a condition, it didn't exist. So all these people who had this condition were fighting a losing battle, living in life in chronic pain. And we did get that diagnostic code by 2015. Fibromyalgia, by the way. It took a lot of lobbying, but we did. And during that time, mental health services, I was under mental health services for dealing with anxiety and chronic pain because I'd been going through it for decades without a diagnosis. So I was frequently in and out of the mental health services because of that. And they asked me to set up a community for fibromyalgia. So I thought, okay, I'll give it a go. Because apparently there wasn't a group in Sunderland. There actually was, but it wasn't up and running at that particular point in time. And it started back up again, I think, when they realised that there was a new group starting. And the other group was under a different charity, under a different fibromyalgia charity. And these two charities didn't get on at all. When you talk about patients who were members of these different charities, there was always squabbling and fighting on the forums. I mean, it was really quite bad. And I didn't realise quite how bad until I set up FibroFlutters, really, to be honest, and got an essence of this. I mean, when we set up for, we were under Fibro Action, and we covered four counties in the northeast. We were the only fibro action fibromyalgia group in the northeast. So, and my four founders, we all lived within these different counties. Whereas the other charity had groups in, every town. So you can imagine what it was like when they opened their group back up, because you weren't allowed to have two groups within a certain
Right.
distance. And anyway, come whether it was 2015 or 2016, those two charities ended up merging. So I ended up technically being a part of that charity anyway. And we decided to work pretty much alongside the other group, because they were running monthly meetings and getting speakers and things in, and we just weren't really set up for that. And plus, we had different ideas. We wanted to be more for chronic illness because we didn't just have fibromyalgia. People had a variety of
Right.
other conditions, and it was too disease specific to run a fibromyalgia group. It was too specific. It had to be about fibromyalgia, and that's not what people wanted. They wanted to be able to come and talk about the irritable bowel syndrome. They wanted to come and talk about the chronic fatigue, their bad backs, their arthritis, and at the end of the day, it's like it was demand, it was needed. And we were very much information oriented as well, so it was pointing people towards where they could get proper information and advice about different health conditions, which is how come the website ended up coming about, to be able to direct people to for resources and things like that. It was also a bit of a blog as well to begin with. I painted a bit of my own journey. But as an organization, really, it was, I don't know, it started off as for fibromyalgia, and then it's just kind of just sprouted in and grown and
Yeah.
grown and grown and grown, but grown organically. And I've added it on year on year. So every birthday I would announce something else. Like May 12th is International Fibromyalgia Awareness Day. That's the day we were born as a group. So something else new would be added on, and including the rare disease element, rare
Right.
disease side of it. One of my co-founders has an ultra rare disease. She's one of about maybe three people in the UK that has this disease, and there are other people with rare diseases within our organization. So that was always going to become a part of it, but we're not disease specific because we can't be disease specific. I
Which
mean,
comes
at the
back to
end,
this point about that, there's a whole new sort of thing to deal
yeah,
with. Is
you
it just to
can.
clarify? Just to clarify one quick point. This is it's not just the four counties anymore, is it?
Yes,
It's a global
yeah.
community,
We've got
basically. Yeah.
the website reaches well, completely. I mean, it is global. It's quite surprising when I look at the stats as to I have had to look up some of the countries to see
So look,
because I've not had a clue.
I'm cutting across you slightly. I know we can spend a lot more time talking about the society start or the group, but obviously what I'm interested in there is where in that journey did you start dealing with the pharma industry and the various groups around the pharma industry, and just quite openly, I'm just quite interested in how you engage with the industry in different ways. I know you've got a number of experiences, so can you just talk us through a little bit of some of those experiences and how you started that?
In 2017, I ended up in a position where I was pretty much in bed, and I could click a mouse. So you can imagine I was very bored. So I spent a lot of time trying to fill my mind, and stumbled across varying webinars and things, and my brain was ticking because it's always been ticking about how I could, get that message out there to industry, how you could get that message beyond the patient communities, because at that, I mean, you were talking to Facebook and you were talking to Twitter, but you weren't necessarily talking to anybody where it really mattered. So it was like, what was I going to do about that? And by 2018, I actually decided, you know what, I'm going to do it. I'm just going to go out there and actually see where I can get. And so I ended up at it was the IFA Pharma conferences, actually. And it was the first pharmaceutical conference I went to in Barcelona in 2018, completely and utterly naive, with my friend, one of my co-founders, who was a she was actually a patient, but she was also a caregiver to her daughter. So we were like a patient and caregiver duet, moderating, facilitating round tables. We'd never done that before. We hadn't got a clue
Can I,
what we were.
again, I'm gonna cut through there because I'm slightly intrigued how you get to Barcelona at that stage. Were you invited? Did someone find you? Did you just go, that looks interesting, I'm gonna go? I mean, I could imagine it was quite interesting for you walking into Hoyt Pharma in
I know
Barcelona.
he
But
won't mind me.
how
I
did
know
you
he
get
won't
there?
mind me. I know he won't mind me saying this, but I saw that this event was running. I'd ended up attending a couple of their webinars,
The
and I
webinars,
was
okay.
and I'm screaming at the laptop, screaming at the laptop, throwing things in chat, and I'm thinking, everybody's thinking, who's that nutter, right? And then I see that this, it flags up at the end, come to our event, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, I've
Yeah.
got to get there. And I literally begged. I'm not
Did you
ashamed
talk
to
to
say it. I literally begged. I emailed and literally begged, gave our story and everything else. And next thing I know, we were heading to Barcelona,
Right,
and we were
excellent, excellent.
facilitating
Okay,
round
and
tables.
that must have opened up quite an interesting number of doors and conversations for you.
It has since, yes. It did. Oh, we were terrified. I'm not going to lie, because we expected it to be full of dirty old men. Because this was the image of farmer, we were
That's a bit
too,
disappointing.
we were two very naive women. Come on. I mean, we knew nothing about the farmer industry. We didn't have a clue. Fortunately for me, Paul's actually mentored me quite a bit within the realms as a
Okay.
patient, because he did, he ran the patient summit as well, so he did quite
Yeah.
a bit for patients.
This is
So
Paul Sims you're talking about, yeah.
So I got to know a lot about the industry through going to the Iver Farmer events. But I also joined an initiative with Patient Focused Medicines Development, who's was made up of different pharmaceutical companies. They set this initiative up, and they had the same mindset, the same idea, the same everything as me. I've got to get involved, because their whole multi-stakeholder approach to everything was just, I mean,
Right.
awe-inspiring for me. And to be get on the doorstep and get involved, I'm a bit like Scrappy Doo, jump, 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 jump. Oh, he's here! Hi, Paul! Jump, jump, jump! Like a little lap, a little dog clanking ankles to get onto things. And I did it, and we wrote them. I managed to get onto the project that was looking specifically at early discovery. For me, that's the one I was on. But they were making the how-to guides for implementing patient engagement into the research and development process. And I have to admit that one of my main roles, and it always is, I'll say, I've done this many times before. Is yeah, I'm, people say about patient partners, but my role a lot of the time is checking language. So I'm actually
Right.
checking the language to make sure that it's feasible for, well, not just patients, as I like to say, because it isn't just about patients anymore, because it's multi-stakeholder. You've got to take everybody into account. Not everybody understands everything anymore. But getting involved with those how-to guides was massive for me. It got me involved in getting across to the likes of Brussels and sitting in workshops and going to the patient engagement open forum and meeting people from Medcoms and meeting people from all over, from everywhere, and growing a network that suited what I was trying to preach. But then I also did realize when I was doing that I couldn't ask people to take a multi-stakeholder approach if I wasn't doing it myself. So then I had to sort of apply that approach to my own my own working, and I've worked it from there since. And I still do work on initiatives with patient-focused medicines, PFMD for short, because it's a mouthful. But those how-to guides, there was a whole series of those guides, and I was involved with a couple of them, and also the trainings. Repository that we built as well, that listed all the different patient engagement trainings that were with
Right.
that we sourced from all over the globe, that all these different people had put together and put
Just
them all on
coming
one.
back. Okay, so just coming back to the industry, and I'm sort of, I mean, can you remember? I think you said 2018 you went to Barcelona for the first time. But you, what's the question? How was, I mean, was how was the industry welcoming? Did they understand? Was there sort of challenges? Were there barriers? And how was it then? And how was it? If it has, how has it changed over the last 5 years? Do you find the industry more welcoming, or I don't want to put words in your mouth. So you just tell me a little bit about your impression of the dirty old men thing. I think I'm going to use at some stage in a different way. That aside, how did you find us as an industry when you actually got to meet us, as it were?
That was what we expected. That is what we thought we was. That's. I mean, this was the vision that we had, because this was new to us. So of course we. I mean, the argument still is now about, balancing, the gender thing within industry. I'd like to think it's a lot better now. It is a lot better. I know it is. I know some very fine women who are working in pharma, and I have to admit that we were so pleasantly surprised back in 2018 about the way we were accepted. We actually
Okay.
sat on the wall outside with our jaws dropped and went, we just didn't know what to say. We were absolutely gobsmacked because we weren't just welcome, but people were talking to us. And I'll never forget I can't remember his name now, but one of the gentlemen who was on the first table we were facilitating actually was so taken in by what we'd said on that round table that he went and changed his speech because he was on stage next.
Okay, cool. Excellent. Well, that's
And
nice. It's cause and effect. It's good.
he did. So that was something, that we'll never forget because you wouldn't expect that to happen. But making noise and being in an environment where we could speak to people who hadn't heard what we had to say before, I think was just something different. And not knowing, I didn't know what patient centricity was. I didn't have a clue. I mean, I
So what
didn't.
sort of, okay, and so you're now part of this industry, or a little bit of part. What, just give us again a little bit of a flavor. We haven't got a huge amount of time, so just give us a couple of examples of the sorts of projects that you've been involved in. Communications type projects or activities you've been involved in that to the benefit of patients that have been funded by or and supported by the industry. Have you got a couple of examples you could share?
Oh God, I'm trying to God. It's like you put me on the spot and my brain goes, what?
Okay, well, we can go in. I'm just trying to get a, so have you been involved in, I don't know, patient advisory groups or something? I mean, there's a lot of Medcoms agents and Pathfinder,
Well,
for instance.
yeah. Patient advisory groups. I'm actually involved with one with Twist Medical at the moment, which is looking into patient engagement publications and the it's hard to explain. It's
Okay,
looking at
sounds.
how those are distributed, how why or how these publications aren't getting distributed, and just looking into patient engagement publications per se. But it's
Okay.
a very new it's very new. It's not quite off the ground really yet, but it's kind of growing, and I look forward to it developing, and I look forward to it hopefully doing something really fantastic. But another project is with my good friend Lorna, who's in the audience, who I met at I hate it when my brain does that. We
Don't worry,
met
don't
at
worry.
a
At a meeting.
we met
Somewhere.
at a, an event, and it was about early access. That's it. Early access, and about how patient engagement doesn't exist in early access at all, really. And how can you educate people and patients? How can you educate them into what early access is and things like that. So there's a new Navigate program that she's just launched at the moment that I'm partner with, along with a few other good people within industry like Rare Revolution magazine are involved with that as well. Where hopefully we'll be able to take the voice of the rare patients and help eventually develop this project that she's got ongoing. I'm looking forward to
Okay.
that as well because it's about how to communicate really what is early access, because you're relying on doctors, and I mean doctors don't tell you diddly squat. So just
But
moving things like
it sounds like your experience is relatively positive working with the industry and with the agencies and so on, which is good to hear. I suppose that the bottom line is, and someone's just asked the question, what can we do more of to support you to help us? That's what it comes down to, isn't it? And well, let me just ask that question, and then there's a couple of things I'd like to just sort of tease out, if I may. But have you thoughts on what more we can do to help you help us? That makes sense.
Th there's
Don't worry about the comments. Ignore those. Don't worry.
To be honest, it's a question that always gets asked, and I know that patients hate answering it because you feel like you're
Okay.
always saying the same things all the time. And I can't really answer giving anything different to what anybody else would say. I mean, it's listen to, I mean, and I'm having
Listen
Alan
to
would be
us.
going, listen to the patient.
Right.
Listen to the patient, but it's partner with the patient. But most importantly, I do this thing at conferences where it's like, it feels like everyone puts the patient in the middle on the table. You've got a nice big round table. The patient's sitting in the middle of the table because that's where you've put us. And it's like, we don't want to sit there. You know what I mean? Do you want to sit in the middle of the table? No, you don't want to sit in the middle of the table. Okay, then I don't want to sit in the middle of the table. So why don't we all sit around it? And this is something, that I strongly advocate for because, we want, it's about developing those relationships, but you don't just develop a relationship and then walk off. You've got to develop a relationship, maintain that relationship, keep it ongoing. Have something in place that makes it more permanent. Create patient ambassador schemes, anything, if you want to keep it specifically within a company, for instance, because there are plenty of things that you can do. I suppose it's more about convincing those people who are higher than the sea level to actually invest in them actually putting these systems in place, because that's the
Let's
biggest downfall that I have seen and noted myself over the years is the fact that they're just not committed to investing in actually creating patient ad boards, even patient ad boards. You
Do you
know what
think
I
there's an
mean?
element of, do you think there's an element of people talking the talk but not walking the walk sort of thing?
There still is. And I have said this, right, because I've said there needs to be some kind of stamp, right, that actually people can recognize. Patient communities need to know that they can trust who they're dealing with. Now, any Joe Blogs can come up to them and say, let's partner up and let's do this. But how do we know that they are worthy of being partnered with? And I've said this for years, that there's no stamp, there's nothing there to give us any, leeway as to finding out who those people actually are. And
Can I
then
just for
the
a couple of
criticism of,
minutes
oh,
just
it's another tick box exercise. Do you know what I mean? And that's what companies think it would be, is, oh, it's just going to be another tick box exercise. Oh, they do this, they do that, they do the other. But at the end of the day, you're supposed to be helping patients. And if patients need this as a service, then surely can you not provide it?
okay, let's I've got one eye on the clock, sorry. But just for a couple of minutes, let's just focus in on events. You've talked about, or you've talked around a little bit in the course of the conversation, attending conferences and activities and so on, but you've also got your mobility problems and so on. So there's a challenge in there, yeah. The one of the things that lots of us talked about going back a couple of years with the pandemic, the lockdowns and so on, it forced people to open up things like events on a virtual basis. That meant more inclusivity and so on and so forth. I just wonder again, this is a whole session in itself, but just tell us a little bit the sense of how challenging it can be for you to get involved in an event, for instance, and how important is it to you, whether it's hybrid or virtual or not? I mean, I know from talking to there's pros and cons. So just talk to us a little bit from your point of view and maybe a little bit of a sense of what the challenges are. Because I think it's genuine, we want to get you involved. Again, I worry that some people are just sort of like talking the talk and not walking the walk. So what's it like from your point of view? And are we going backwards at the moment? That's my killer. That's my question.
That's a good
Have we opened it
question.
up and then started to go backwards as we all get back to face-to-face meeting? I'll stop whittering. You tell us for a couple of minutes about
That's a
your
very
experience of the
good
events.
question because are they going backwards? I one of the biggest pet hates I have are those that won't even pay for one night's accommodation, or pay for travel expenses, or provide any kind of stipend towards travel and accommodation, but yet still expect you to get on stage and speak. That still happens, believe it or not, that still happens. And it should stop. It's not, you know, at the end of the day, we're very small. We're not getting the expenses paid back by some company. We're not getting paid the money back. I mean, where do they think this money comes from? Mine comes out of my disability benefits. So, I mean, at the end of the day, it's like those kind of things it's a message that really strongly needs to get out when you're talking about people attending events and conferences. And then you're talking about the virtual element. It's fantastic. I went to God knows how many events during the pandemic because I didn't have to travel. But the networking was awful because it
Right.
just wasn't the same. I like the in-person touch for meeting people and networking. But getting there, getting to a conference is really bad. I'll give you an example. Going to the Reuters Pharma event earlier on in the year, getting to Barcelona is an absolute pain in the backside for me because there are no directs from Newcastle to Barcelona, absolutely none. So you have to fly from Newcastle to either Amsterdam or Paris. If you go KLM or Air France, if you go Ryanair, then you run the risk of all kinds. You don't want to go with Ryanair, right? Anyway, I got stranded in Schiphol Airport for 12 hours. I was in my wheelchair as well, so I had passenger assistance booked. They basically gave me two blankets, some tokens to buy some food and drink, and packed me up in the airport for 12 hours until the plane left in
Left you
the
there.
morning. Yeah, so I arrived late to the event as well and everything else. But on the way back, I arrived back in Newcastle minus my suitcase and my wheelchair. So, you know, all of these things, traveling is a nightmare. I love to travel, but the elements of not being able to take the wheelchair when I'm traveling because you just can't run the risk of it just. A getting
Disappearing.
damaged as well because things get damaged. Mobility aids get damaged. The way that they throw things around is frightening. Things get broken. So, you know, and then there's accessibility. I've been to a few places where the events where accessibility for people has been shocking. I've had to go up in the tradesman's lift to get in upstairs to get to the floor I'm meant to be at for a conference. And that happened this year, earlier on this year, because to get up there was like 12 steps. And it
And
was also an
so,
event where I was the only patient as well at that.
right, okay. So there's a bit of tokenism going on, possibly, and a bit of like, you know, people just haven't thought it through because you're the one person who faces the problems that you're facing, sort of thing, which is a bit of a sad reflection on the organisers. But I guess it's just one of those things. You know, we all face problems all the time, don't we? Or as organisers, how do you cover off the organisation for everybody, sort of thing? But to come back to the virtual side of it, you say you've attended a lot of the virtual meetings. I mean, from your point, and you've made an important point that the networking isn't the same as on. But from your point of view, virtual must have opened up all sorts of possibilities. Again, have you found the organisers are in us? My question remains at the moment. Are organisers still going down that route and offering you that opportunity, or are we going back to face-to-face? Therefore, that's the way it's going to work, and therefore we should be thinking about how to get you there. I can't quite work out there in the real world how many people are what's aware on that sort of spectrum. But just talk a little bit about your experience at the moment.
It's just expensive.
The
It's all about money to
travel.
get there. Because there was a lot of events that I managed to get to that were accessible to everybody kind of during the pandemic, whereas now it's like it's costing. And I mean, I'm quite brash. I've often, you know, emailed them and said, "Hi, you know, I'm a patient, blah, 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 blah. Do you have special rates for people like me?" And every now and again, you know, they come back and say, "Yeah, it's okay, you don't need to pay. You know, here you go, here's a link." But that isn't all how it always is. But if there's an event over in America, for instance, I mean, that you really want to go to, and you know, it's like, hope, you know, you'd like to think there's going to be access, but the events aren't hybrid anymore. So a lot of the events as well, not only do they cost, but a lot of the events that were over in America, that then they're not running virtual streams. So they've stopped. So you've got no access to these anymore unless you actually get on an airplane
So
and go.
we're agreeing that we're sort of going backwards from that point of view. So meetings are closing down rather than opening, having opened up, they're now effectively closing back down
Some of
to
them
if you can't get to our venue. But you see.
because I mean some of them they might have I mean I know it's not particularly easy if you've got a multi-tracked event to be able to stream it all online. I mean, crikey, the technology behind doing something like that would be phenomenal. But and some of them do, they'll highlight the main, the main stage, as it were, or the main keynotes and things like that, so you get access to stuff like that. But it's still not the same, is it? It's not the same as being at the real thing. I mean, that's my personal preference.
Exactly. Yeah, 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 yeah. Okay. I guess there's all sorts of little bits in there we could talk about. I just know that we've gone past time, so I'm slightly frustrated because I think this would be interesting to carry on going. But we have a time limit. We should stop there. I guess I just find it fascinating listening to you, and it makes my mind work a lot about some of the projects I've been involved in the past and might yet, and how we can make it more inclusive, frankly, and how we can involve people with all sorts of voices from all sides. I do find it interesting listening to someone like yourself talk about dealing with the healthcare professionals and that sort of lack of a multidisciplinary approach. And I guess we've all got examples in our own lives about it, and it drives me nuts. I don't know what the answer is, but I think you very clearly illustrated the challenge with this with the health system. I'm gonna say a huge thank you to you. I would like to believe that people have had some got some food for thought and some ideas, and it's just interesting hearing your experiences. I will say, I know I can say it for you, that if people would like to contact you directly, you'd welcome it, and you'd love to talk to them. Please, LinkedIn is an easy way of doing it, or via through FibroFlutter's website. But talking to you directly via LinkedIn is an easy way of contacting you. So hopefully anybody online today or watching the video later will follow that opportunity. So I'm going to wish you all the best. I'm going to say a huge thank you for joining us. I'm going to say to the audience today, don't all rush away if you don't need to, because we're here for another few minutes. But for the sake of the recording, huge thank you to you. If anyone's interested in what I'm doing, medcomsnetworking.com. But otherwise, just give us a little wave and we'll say goodbye for today. Bye then. Cheers.